Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Flory, Judge Connolly, and Judge Reyes, the Honorable James Flory presiding.
Good morning, counsel, and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Thanks for your patience this morning. It was a odd morning where we actually got ahead of ourselves a little bit. So the third case on for oral argument this morning is Ronald James Fairbanks, petitioner, versus State of Minnesota, court file A210077. As you both know, our rules are the same here today, even though we're appearing virtually, meaning you each have 15 minutes for your principal arguments, and counsel for appellant, you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you wish. We are recording the proceedings here today, and we will make those recordings available to the public during our normal course of business, and any additional recording is prohibited by our rules. Please identify yourselves for our record as you begin your arguments, and with that, counsel for appellant, you may proceed.
Morning. May it please the court, Nick Campanario on behalf of the appellant, State of Minnesota. We're here on an appeal from a district court's order granting an exoneration compensation petition under section 590.11. And the essential issue is whether the petitioner, Mr. Fairbanks, falls within a particular provision of that statute, namely the last sentence of subdivision 2. The last sentence of subdivision 2 is limited to people who did not meet the court action and prosecutorial dismissal requirements in old subdivision 11I for July 1, 2019. The provision is clear and it's unambiguous in that regard. And so in other words, the statute is limited to people like the petitioner in Back versus State, which is the case where the Minnesota Supreme Court struck down old subdivision 11I as unconstitutional. Ms. Back met the court action requirement before July 1, 2019, but she did not meet the prosecutorial dismissal requirement. And so someone like Ms. Back falls within the last sentence of subdivision 2, and she has benefited from that provision, as we explained in our reply brief. The problem is that Mr. Fairbanks is not like Ms. Back. Unlike Ms. Back, Mr. Fairbanks did meet the court action and prosecutorial dismissal requirements in old subdivision 11I before July 1, 2019. He met the court action requirement in May 2017, when this court reversed his judgment of conviction on grounds consistent with innocence, and he met the prosecutorial dismissal requirement in January 2018, when the prosecutor dismissed the sole charge against him. So as a result, unlike Ms. Back, Mr. Fairbanks doesn't fall within the last sentence of subdivision 2.
Does it make a difference, Mr. Campanario, that the prosecution dismissal in this matter occurred after Back, which basically declared such a dismissal an illegal act, so therefore the second prong wasn't met because it occurred after Back? Does that make a difference here?
No, it doesn't. So the timeline is the reversal of the conviction occurred before Back, then Back happened, and then the prosecutorial dismissal happened after Back. For whatever reason, what the legislature has directed us to do in the last sentence of subdivision 2 is to look back to old subdivision 11I as it existed in the original version of the statute and determine whether a person did or did not meet those requirements before a specific measurement date, July 1, 2019. And that matches up with the effective date of the amendments. And so that's why that date was chosen.
But Mr. Campanario, the dismissal by the prosecutor, as Judge Floyd pointed out, occurred after BAC, and after BAC held that provision to be basically invalid. And so as a result, it seems that the dismissal of those charges was not legally possible at all. So how is that element met then?
I'm following on the timeline. I guess I'm not following how BAC made it illegal for the prosecutor to dismiss charges. It is undisputed that that is what happened in this case. After this court reversed Mr. Fairbanks's conviction, it remanded the case, and so the charge in his case still existed.
And just let me clarify one point. If I said that the state's dismissal was illegal, that's not the proper term I wanted to use. I think that it was not legally possible following the BAC decision.
The BAC decision didn't have any impact on a prosecutor's ability to dismiss a charge. What BAC did affect was the type of person who is eligible to pursue a claim for exoneration compensation. And it limited things to people who had a new trial order entered in their case. So that was the import of BAC. Before BAC, during BAC, after BAC, you name it. Prosecutors were still able to dismiss charges in cases where a conviction had been reversed. And that's exactly what happened here.
But in BAC, the BAC court concluded that subdivision 1, sub 1I, that the legislature has set up a regime under which a claimant's eligibility to file a compensation petition is contingent on whether the prosecutor has performed a legally impossible act.
Yeah.
And the court went on to conclude that there was a violation of equal protection because there's no rational basis for that classification. So the BAC court did talk about whether the state could perform, whether the prosecutor had performed a legally impossible act.
Yeah, and so in a certain type of case, there is no charge left for the prosecutor to dismiss. That was the situation in BAC's case, because in BAC's case, her conviction was, I believe the way the Supreme Court described it, was an outright reversal. The appellate court reverses the conviction, a judgment of acquittal results, the case is over and done. That is different from what happened in this case, where Mr. Fairbanks' conviction was reversed and then the case was remanded back to the district court. In that type of case, there still is a live charge to be acted upon, and there still is a way for the prosecutor to dismiss it. So that's the distinction there.
What then should Mr. Fab, what should have, under your scenario, what should Mr. Fairbanks have done in order to get compensation between the BAC decision and the language in the subdivision? I mean, what should he have done?
There was nothing to be done.
So he's out to lunch.
Yes, just like every other person in the state who didn't have a new trial order entered in his or her case, after BAC and before the amendments in terms of new alleged exonerations, they were out in the cold. That was the effect of BAC.
That seems like an absurd result.
If you're saying that the decision in Back v. State led to an absurd result, that may be the case.
No, he's not. I mean, obviously, Judge Reyes can speak for himself. I don't think anyone here is going to say the Supreme Court acted absurdly. But I mean, what I think Judge Reyes is getting to, and quite frankly, which I agree with, is it sounds like that result would be absurd, and we never assume the legislature is trying to get absurd results.
Yeah, and in cases like this one, where the statute that we're talking about is clear and unambiguous, in general, we don't concern ourselves with whether the results seem reasonable to us, absurd to us, makes great sense, makes little sense, or any of that. There is an exception.
Well, I certainly don't agree with that. I think we always try to go with plain language and apply that. But, you know, if it seems like the application results an absurd result, there's a whole line of cases that say, no, you know, we don't do that either. So, you know, that's just my thoughts.
Yeah. And I would say that as a general rule, the canon of construction that allows courts to tinker with statutes if they lead to an absurd or unreasonable result generally does not apply to clear and unambiguous statutes. That's what the cases say. There is the exception to that rule, which we've discussed in our briefs. It is fairly often invoked by parties. It is almost never actually used by courts. And there's no good reason to use it in this case. I think where the absurdity or unreasonableness comes in is in the differing treatment between two classes of people that seem to be similarly situated. Why are people like Ms. Back being given the benefit that's provided by the last sentence of subdivision 2, whereas people like Mr. Fairbanks, who may seem equally deserving, don't get that benefit? That type of argument, which let's acknowledge it, at least as far as I'm concerned, has some force. That type of argument leads to the conclusion that this new provision, the last sentence of subdivision 2, is unconstitutional. That's the conclusion that follows from that type of argument. That was the problem with the original definition of exonerated, and that was identified by the Supreme Court in Back. And that seems to be a problem that has been repeated in the last sentence of subdivision 2. What do you do about that? You cannot rewrite a statute that's clear and unambiguous to avoid a constitutional problem. If a clear and unambiguous—
Mr. Campanario, my point was, and Judge Connelly is absolutely right in terms of where I was going, as he rightly notes, there's not only a full line of case law that says that we don't enforce a result that the legislature would end in an absurd result. I mean, there's case law on that, but there's even statutes. Minnesota Statute 645.17, Subdivision 1. Clearly states that the legislature does not intend a result that is absurd or unreasonable. And it seems that the result that you're advocating for, where people will be left without any remedy whatsoever, seems absurd, seems unreasonable. So why is it? It seems like you are implicitly acknowledging that. So why I'm trying to understand your argument as to why we should go down that path and accept your approach.
Yeah, and I don't, it may be because we're having a disagreement about what happens when you have a clear and unambiguous statute. And my understanding from the cases we cited in our brief on this point is that the anti-absurdity canon, if you will, generally does not apply to clear and unambiguous statutes. When a clear and unambiguous statute is at issue, you apply the plain meaning without getting into spirit, purpose, absurdity, unreasonableness, etc., except in the one very limited class of cases that's discussed in Wegner and in the other precedents we decided in our brief. I'm running out of time. I've got 5 seconds left. So,
well, actually, you don't have anything left now. So there you go.
Well, Mr. Campanaria, you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Thank you for your argument. We'll move on to respondent here. Counsel for respondent, you may proceed.
Yes, good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court and counsel. My name is Zorislav Lederman. I represent Mr. Fairbanks, as the court is aware. Mr. Fairbanks received a favorable order in St. Louis County for compensation. The state has appealed, and that's why we're here today. Your Honors, the court has three options at this point in terms of how to proceed with this case. Option number one, the court can determine that this extended statute of limitations in subdivision 2 applies to Mr. Fairbanks, and that the court's order will be enforced. Option number two, the court can decide that the extended limitation period does not apply and just stop there and tell Mr. Fairbanks, you know, sorry, there appears to be kind of a technical loophole here, and so we're just going to wrap it up. And you can hang out and see what happens in legislature in a few more years. Or option three, this court can do what Beg did. The court can actually sever that entire last sentence of subdivision 2 and remove it from the statute. We are advocating for option number one for this court to decide that the extension applies to Mr. Fairbanks. In our view, that is the most reasonable way to resolve this issue with regards not only to Mr. Fairbanks, but also with regards to other people who rely on the statute and file various petitions, and also with regards to what the legislature intended clearly to do when it wrote that last sentence into subdivision 2 in 2019. Now, the general rule that Mr. Campanaria talked about and the court is aware is correct, that generally, if we have a clear and unambiguous statute, we will apply the plain meaning of that statute as it's written. Even though sometimes that'll produce strange results, that's the rule that's applied and that's how we do it. But in doing that, we have to remember the canons of statutory construction that were mentioned earlier from section 645.17. The first one is that the legislature never intends an absurd or unreasonable result. And the second one is that the legislature never intends to violate the Constitution, the U.S. Constitution or the Minnesota Constitution. And so with that, there is that exception. There are many cases the court has mentioned. We rely on Schatz versus Interfaith Care Center, but there are many others. And what these cases say is that courts are allowed to override the plain meaning of a clear statute if the plain meaning utterly confounds the clear legislative purpose and intent of the same statute. So that brings us to the next point, which is, was there some clear legislative purpose behind that extended statute of limitations? And if so, what was it? And does this result that the state advocates here go against everything that the legislature intended to do with that extended statute of limitations? And so in order to answer these questions, we have to go back to the Bagg decision and figure out what happened there and what prompted the legislature to act and what was the legislature doing in 2019 when these amendments came about. Bagg determined that there are two classes of innocent petitioners who are both equally innocent, but who have who end up with a very different result. The one class is the Mr. Fairbanks types, people who have a reversal and a remand on appeal. They go back to the district court and then the prosecutor dismisses the case. The second type of exonerees are the Mrs. Becks. These are the people that have a reversal of their conviction on appeal, but then the case is over. She went to trial, her conviction was reversed. It was not remanded. The case was over. So under the pre-existing statute, she didn't qualify because there was nothing left to dismiss, even though the statute called for some kind of dismissal, and Mr. Fairbanks did. The Supreme Court in Bagg decided to sever that entire provision from subdivision one. And I think it's important to realize why they did that, because the dissent in Bagg advocated for what we're trying to accomplish here now. The dissent wanted the statute to be applied constitutionally rather than to be severed. The majority in Bagg determined that there was some very important legislative goal behind this prosecutorial dismissal provision, that the legislature meant something very important by that. The Supreme Court couldn't figure out what it was because it was an illegal act to dismiss a case that's already over. But that's why they severed it, with the hope that the legislature would pick this up and fix the problem. It turns out, if we go back and look at the legislative history, is that this idea of the prosecutor dismissing the charges really wasn't that important to the legislature. What they wanted to accomplish is to make sure that people who committed some kind of a crime don't get compensated, that we're going to compensate the truly innocent, the people that had one conviction or multiple convictions and everything went away, so that we were not paying people who committed the crime and that conviction stuck, but then they're going to be compensated. And so back happened. The legislature actually waited. There was a lot of discussion during the next legislative session. The statute was not amended. I believe it was a year later after back that finally the amendments came about. And so what was the legislature trying to accomplish through this last sentence of subdivision two? And the clear answer that it appears even the state admits is the legislature wanted to fix the unfairness that it created through the original language and how it was interpreted by Beck. The legislature wanted the people who were not able to get compensated, the innocent people who were not able to get compensated because of Beck, to have a short period during which they can go back and recover compensation. And so how is it possible that after we have the Supreme Court's Beck decision, where the Supreme Court decides that you cannot treat similarly situated innocent people differently, how is it possible that the legislature, given that decision, is going to go back and create another unconstitutional statute that permits Ms. Beck to go back and get compensation, but not Mr. Fairbanks? It's the reversal of the same problem that we had him back. And so this is why our position, Your Honor, is that this is it's an unconstitutional result. First of all, it creates an equal protection problem because now we have Ms. Back who is able to be compensated, Mr. Fairbanks can't. And it's also an absurd result. Again, how could the legislature intended to create this outcome shortly after the Supreme Court issued a decision back and told the legislature to fix the problem with the statute that got them there in the first place? And this is also why our position is that even though typically we don't apply the exception, Mr. Campanario is correct that a lot of times that exception is invoked. It's rarely applied. But this is a rare case where it should be applied, because we know that what the legislature was trying to accomplish is not what's actually happening in real life, because now we have Mr. Fairbanks, who's out of his back, is going to be able to recover compensation, and Mr. Fairbanks will not. And that's clearly not what the legislature wanted to do. It's an absurd result, and it's the complete opposite of what the legislature was attempting to do in the first place. So with that in mind, our position is that the appropriate resolution here is to apply that extended statute of limitations constitutionally to mean that it applies to Mr. Fairbanks, even though the clear language of that extension appears not to apply to him. Alternatively, if the court decides that it must apply the statute as written and apply the technical language, I think that only leaves one other alternative, and that's for the court to sever that entire extension from the remainder of the statute, because if the court decides that this is a similar situation to back where we need to send the statute back to the legislature to fix an unconstitutional provision, then that's the only other way to do it is to sever it. Our view is that just telling Mr. Fairbanks that, sorry, this doesn't apply to you, and leaving it at that is not a proper way to resolve this case. And it doesn't serve the public interest, because then Mr. Fairbanks is out and we have an unconstitutional statute that is going to be left as is without any sort of a signal to the legislature to fix the fight. Again, our view, Your Honor, is that the statute is that the extension should apply to Mr. Fairbanks. And that's what we're asking the court to do. I have 5 minutes left, but I don't have any other arguments, so I'll just end it here unless the court has any questions.
Seeing none, thank you, Mr. Lederman. Mr. Campanario, you do have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. I get the argument that the last sentence of Subdivision 2 as written may be unconstitutional. And again, if that's the case, then you don't rewrite, you sever. What I have a harder time with is the separate argument that this court should override the plain meaning of the statute because the plain meaning utterly confounds a clear legislative purpose. Where is the evidence that the legislature, had a clear purpose or intent to cover people like Mr. Fairbanks in the last sentence of Subdivision 2, which is what we're talking about? I've reviewed the legislative history of the amendments, at least to the extent that that history is available to me. I didn't see anything that shed any light on what the legislature was thinking with regard to the last sentence of Subdivision 2. There's been nothing in that regard cited by Mr. Fairbanks either. So in terms of the material before the court, it's somewhat of a blank slate. What we do know is that the legislature went out of its way to limit that provision to people like Ms. Back. I don't know why. I don't think anyone in this room knows why. It would have been the easiest thing in the world for them to write it in a different way, such as by saying this applies to anybody who is adversely affected by Back's invalidation of old Subdivision 11I. They didn't do that. They could have said this applies to anybody who didn't meet both requirements or people who met one but not the other. There's any number of ways they could have drafted the provision to cover not only people like Ms. Back, but also people like Mr. Fairbanks. They did not do so. There seems to be some intent behind that. And so if a court is asked—
I guess, counsel, I understand your arguments. The problem I'm having with it is certainly, you know, recent Supreme Court precedent dealing with these types of issues. For example, you know, I'm thinking of the amelioration doctrine dealing with the Drug Sentencing Reform Act. Our Supreme Court seems to be having a more expansive view of when, you know, these dates apply and when these exceptions occur, do or do not occur. And just looking at those cases by analogy, you know, clearly they were trying to deal, you know, the legislature was trying to respond to that decision and sort of keep a group of people who they viewed as potentially being exonerated because they were factually innocent, alive. And, I mean, are you suggesting, for example, I mean, you know, it's already July of 21. I mean, are there just a whole group of people here just waiting in the wings for Mr. Fairbanks' counsel to jump in so that, you know, I mean, my hunch is this is not just like just hundreds and hundreds of people who are just gonna, you know, come out of the woodwork here. But so what are your thoughts about A, that issue? And then my first issue, which was, you know, it seems to me our Supreme Court is going for a more liberal interpretation as it's applied to these exceptions and deadlines.
With regard to how many people would this affect, I, as someone who works in St. Louis County, have somewhat limited visibility into that. I know that this is the only petition of this nature that we've received here. In terms of appellate decisions, I'm not aware of any case allowing somebody like Mr. Fairbanks to proceed under the last sentence of subdivision 2. My thought would be many people looking at that provision and just seeing the black and white of what's on the page just wouldn't move forward with a petition if they were in Mr. Fairbanks' shoes, because they don't fall within the plain language. In terms of there being a trend, I know I'm out of time, in terms of there being a trend within the Supreme Court towards more liberality in this regard, I haven't read every Supreme Court decision. I'm not familiar with the ones that you were talking about on the amelioration doctrine. So I don't have a lot to say on that.
Thank you, Mr. Campanario. And thanks to both counsel for your briefing and argument on the issue. It's an interesting issue, and we will take the matter under advisement and we'll issue a decision on the matter within the statutory timeframe. Thank you. We stand adjourned on this matter.
Thank you.